Pants.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the big show. I'm Jeff Gamet. I'm your interim host, sitting in for Ewan Rankin. And I'm super happy to be here today because I get to hang out with amazingly cool people. And it's just an absolute treat to get to do that. So let's see who some of these cool people are. Oh my gosh, Patrice, you're back. What a happy surprise. How are you?
Me cool? Not gonna happen. I'm doing all right. I'm a little bit under the weather. Well, I guess I ca caught the flu somewhere while traveling last week, as it happens, or it's just the weather change, also possible. It dropped almost like 20 degrees Fahrenheit, actually more, from like high 70s to like mid 50s. So almost 30 even.
Wow.
This week, like, it was really warm on Monday, and then Tuesday it dropped, and since then it's been the typical October weather. Like, that's it's it was abnormally warm in September and beginning of October, so it's fine. Like, simply part of the see part of this weird thing that's called seasons, which I don't
Oh
like,
yeah,
but
the thing.
yeah, it's a thing. Yeah, Seasons, one star. yeah, one star,
Right.
can't recommend. But no, it was good, and it was really, I had a really great time in Portugal, so I
That's
really
awesome.
highly recommend it.
Awesome.
Yeah, so it was fun.
Oh,
I'm
welcome
good,
back.
thank you.
All right. Well, also cool, and with a future so bright, he has to wear shades. Ben, how are you?
Am great, Jeff.
And you look absolutely fantastic, as always.
Absolutely. I cannot see a thing, but I look good doing it.
And that's what really matters.
Absolutely.
Yep. Ian, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. I'm back again now after my travels, been over to Istanbul. That was great fun. Had a
Awesome,
really good
and welcome
conference.
back.
Had a really good conference. It was a lovely place. I was very impressed with sort of the difference of Istanbul kind of thing. You know, we got our conference done by midday on the Tuesday. It was a 2 day, it was a day and a half conference. So lunchtime on the last day, we had an afternoon to get down into the city, and the city's amazing. All kinds of things, there's spice bazaars and all that kind of thing, and big mosques and everything. It was fantastic to have a look and to see these kind of things that you normally see in pictures, the Sophia Mosque and all those kind of things. All really interesting to see. It's great fun. Great fun. And the taxi drivers are completely and utterly insane, as is true of almost every city I ever seem to go to these days. Taxi drivers, Formula One drivers would. I'm trying to work out whether I can plan some kind of race system where we can get taxi drivers from Delhi, from Istanbul, from Bucharest, from London, and a few others, and have them all race each other over a street circuit and see who gets there first.
You should pitch that to, I don't know, Amazon or BBC or something. Like, that would be a show I would watch.
I would
Taxi
watch. Racers.
I honestly, the
See.
Turkish taxi driver has a no, and markings on the road, while those are for, they don't matter. Literally two lanes of traffic, and then there's the box they put, the safety bit, the ghost island, the empty hash marks that they have, the kind of dividing the roads up. I just drive down those, and then then force their way into a gap in the cut four cars ahead, so they're a bit further along. And then when you're traveling in kind of convoy like this, they just kind of swerve nicely in between all the cars to see how fast they can get along. It's brilliant. I was with my colleague. My colleague was white-faced and going, oh. And he's used to Bucharest traffic, which is equally madness. And I was going, no, it's fine. Still not done Delhi. No, you haven't lived yet.
If you survive.
And I've survived all of these things so far.
So
It's
far.
all good fun. All
But
good
you haven't
fun.
been to Delhi.
I've been to Delhi. I've done taxi rides in Delhi. I have full experience of this. Survival of the biggest, basically. There, the whole world centers around the idea that the biggest thing is the king of the road, and so that gets priority. It's madness, and there's five cars in a road designed for two, but it all works. Everyone gets
It
around,
works.
and the madness of the amount of cars all packed into one place is, and but everything seems to work, and no one dies. And then you get things that would never happen in the West. Like there's the family moped, which is my favourite thing. You see it all the time, particularly in India, where dad's on the front on the moped riding and he's got a crash helmet on. Dad's a mum sat on the back. She's in a sari, no helmet, bouncing along on the back, just sat side saddle, bouncing along on the back. And then a baby in her arms normally. Gently as they and they'll be bouncing away the other, and that's completely normal and safe, apparently.
Well, it's completely normal.
Oh my god. And of course there's people clinging to the top of buses and stuff like that. That's normal. And trains. Again, that's normal. It's fantastic.
But you know what the difference is? There's not like 5,000 SUVs around them.
Yeah.
No, there is a few. Difference. There's not as many. More now than there used to be, but there was, when I was there last, it was all these sort of smaller cars and the classic Hindustani Ambassador, which is an old English Austin that got transplanted over there and they made millions of them. But modern cars now are very much a thing. There's a lot of money at Delhi and stuff. There's more money appearing now. And Western cars you'd recognise from Europe, you'll see over there now more often than not.
Yeah, but not as bad as in the US.
Yeah, no. Everything's about 7 foot long.
Well, I guess that brings us back to the U.S. and to the man who has no need to know about seasons. Tom, how are you?
Believe it or not, we get seasons in Northern California. I hate wintertime. So I love the fall weather. But
you get barely seasons.
It gets cold. It relatively gets cold. It gets close to freezing here in the wintertime. At close night for 10 minutes. Yeah, close to freezing.
Close to.
Yeah, she should talk to Ben about that. Like, it lives in a freezer all winter. So
yeah,
that's the difference.
Yeah,
bit spoiled, maybe a little bit.
Yeah, I might get close to 0 degrees Fahrenheit.
Mm-hmm. during the day.
During the day.
Goes down.
Yes, right. There.
In August.
There's typically a week every year, although that's kind of changing as overall temperatures are rising. But typically there's a week every year here where we get excited if the temperature gets up to 0 Fahrenheit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, the other side of that is I don't have to deal with what you dealt with a couple days ago, which is an earthquake.
Right, and that may be relevant later on in today's show.
Ooh.
But we also have to talk about, I think it was last week I wore my South Africa rugby jersey, go Springboks.
Mm-hmm.
And both England and South Africa won their matches last week. So guess what? Saturday, it's kind of a big match. I have to say, Ian, I don't know anything about rugby. It's just that when I was in South Africa, I liked the rugby jersey Springbok. And the guy's selling it, so I bought one.
Yeah, the green Springbok. Watched... Have you got the green Springboks one with the...
I do. I should have put it on today.
I was talking to some South Africans last week. Yeah.
But, you know, I watched the matches, and there's a ball, and there's a bunch of guys, and sometimes they get into a clinch and a scrum, and then sometimes they run. Once in a while, they kick. And then the points change, and I can't quite figure it out.
you've got the gist.
Yeah, I've never seen an American football game in person in stadium. I've once seen a baseball game, but I have been to a rugby match with Ewan and with Muller. And I don't remember who else was there. It was probably Ewan's son, blanking on his name now. Like, it was a lot of fun. I no clue what happened, no clue who won. I know the Wasps played because that's their team. I think I have like something that they gave me from, like, that had Wasps on it somewhere.
it was a lot of fun. About right, like, for Birmingham.
Yeah, it was fun. So highly recommend that. It was freezing cold. But they had really nice, like, warm, like, pastries and stuff.
Nice. But rugby is fantastic to watch. Mm-hmm. I'd like rugby over football/soccer for the Americans, and mm-hmm. It is.
I didn't care.
I just saw Ben Bund in the chat. Yeah. Rugby is a bit like NFL years ago. There's no body armor. The rules are broad. You can squint and kind of the rules have some crossover. And our rugby league, if you've ever seen rugby league, Ben, that's a little bit more American football league.
Yeah, I mean, league, union, Aussie rules, Gaelic, and gridiron all come from the rugby side of the football codes.
Yeah.
Which the funny thing is, the one with the circular ball association football, soccer,
yeah,
is actually the outlier to the codes of football.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
I have no idea.
There it is. Just said, you got a wasp scarf.
Good. Yeah, wasps, definitely.
All right. Go Hawkeyes. Yeah. Oh, except for
no wasps.
Bees.
We can change that to make it better.
No. It's wasps. Much better. proper game when people don't need to wear body armor. Although they might ought to, really.
I don't care about sports at all. People get. But it was fun. It was fun because of the company. Right. And Muller got getting shit faced, so that was fun.
Edit point.
All right. Well, that seems like the perfect place to transition into actually talking about news. And yep. Ben, you have the first story.
Yep. So we're going to talk about some risks that have nothing to do with sports.
I see what you did there.
Yeah. And this one has me both surprised and intrigued. So Qualcomm, who right now is probably the biggest supplier of ARM processors and SoCs in the world, is working with Google to make a next generation Wear OS device powered by a RISC-V architecture chip.
Interesting.
Yep. While the device itself, probably aren't that much of note, given the strained history of ARM and Qualcomm of late, stepping back to ARM's purchase of, God, now I forget their names, the desktop guys that were made by all ex-Apple people.
You mean Qualcomm's purchase?
Yeah, Qualcomm. Yeah, you know what I mean.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of that company. Mm. But yeah, they're no idea. To say they're not friendly anymore is an understatement.
to the point where ARM has tried to cancel Qualcomm's license.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's quite interesting. I mean, both are, from what I understand, RISC processors. So it's probably not a big step for them. But they don't need the ARM license anymore. So there's that. Yeah.
Right, so you might remember about 6 months ago, I did a article about Google planning to make RISC-based Android as part of their primary OS. I mean, yeah, in their Android builds. Mm-hmm. They announced it at some RISC conference. There was a RISC conference in January, February, and they planned to. And it's all because people want to a second source to ARM. They're all getting strong ARM by ARM. Pardon the tongue. and RISC V people had another conference this week. I actually had this story as a potential one too.
I have a question. Is there something happening in the chip world? Because there's I had another two chip stories for this week. Like there's Intel and AMD even releasing stuff. So is there something going on?
I think a lot of it is people coming back from vacation in August, and there's a whole lot of stuff going on. But in this case, RISC-V group had a conference. I forget where. There was all kinds of announcements. So even this one was an announcement of a plan to create these chips. But it sounds like they're actively working on it. And I'm guessing they've already taped them out and they're getting them manufactured pretty soon.
Let me guess. They're playing RISC and they're invading, I don't know, Brazil.
I see what you did there.
That's a different kind of RISC.
But I have to say, as small as this product category is, this should be seen as a major shot across the bow to ARM.
It's definitely, that's exactly why Qualcomm went to this conference and talked about it.
Yeah, because if they can move their watch processors to RISC-V, they can move their Android SoCs to RISC-V, and they can move their desktop line to RISC-V.
Right, all the Snapdragons.
I'm not so sure. I mean, Tom probably knows this better, but I would guess you cannot say that. Like, doing something for a small form factor, low power device like a watch or any wear device is different than a smartphone and is even way more different than doing a desktop. Like, it doesn't scale up that way. It might be, and we'll see how, if they can do it, if they can pull it off. But you can't say, okay, just because they did it for the watch, it may be going to work. It's going to work for desktops.
You could probably do it functionally, but it wouldn't perform very well.
Yeah.
But I think Ben is right. This is the... Qualcomm wants to give the impression that they have the potential of switching their entire Snapdragon line over to RISC-V. That's what they want them to know.
Yeah. And for them, that might be a big benefit because then they have more control over it, right?
Yeah. They also don't pay licensing, right?
Yeah.
Right. It's an open source thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, is it that much? Probably not. But
no, it's a. It's from Berkeley. UC Berkeley, I think, owns the IP for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, to me, this sounds like Qualcomm kind of wants to get the same type of deal that Apple's getting.
Probably.
Yeah. I think the biggest thing is to have two sources. You know, we were talking before the show about competition with internet providers. It's the same thing here. Mm-hmm. Even if Qualcomm keeps using both, you know, ARM and RISC-V, they get to play them off each other.
Yeah.
And to a user, I don't care if my Snapdragon that's running Android is RISC-V or ARM, as long as it performs okay.
Yeah. And I mean, that's usually, I think that's why it's not just about the competition in itself, like the competition pushing kind of things. It's also that you can kind of play off all options and say, okay, this processor is better for this type of thing, and that processor is better for that type of thing because they're different. So they might be equivalent, but they're different, but they're better in different things. So if you have more options, you can do more things with it.
So yeah, that's probably true. And of course, with these kind of cores, you know, you buy the standard IP, but you can modify it too. And like you say, it might be easier to modify a RISC-V for a very low power watch processor. Maybe it's easier than an ARM. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could be.
Well, and if you are planning on scaling up in size for devices and you want a proof of concept, a good place to start would be a wearable. Yeah. And then work your way up from there.
Yeah. I mean, it's big enough to send a message, but not big enough to be a significant part of their portfolio.
Yeah, that would take years. But like you said, it sends the message. If they keep having trouble with ARM, they'll just pour more money into RISC-V development.
And you have to start somewhere.
Yeah, you got to start somewhere. I don't know from an OS point of view if a watch OS is that much easier than a phone OS in terms of, the underlying silicon to support it. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine it's a lot simpler, but it might be a little simpler.
A little, at least. I mean, it depends also what you want to do with the watch. Like for simpler watches, you don't need as much power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't need 20 GPU cores, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So it's probably, I mean, it's challenging on the power usage side. Right. They're probably more challenging because phones simply have more space where you can put mm-hmm. in a battery. But on the other hand, you can, it's usually not like because people are not using it all day to play games or something, you can get away with a little bit less power.
Okay. Well, I think that brings us to Ian's story, which doesn't look like a good story, at least for some employees.
Yeah, it's another sort of redundancies in the tech industry story, but this was kind of, and I picked this way partly because of what we were talking about at the beginning of the show with you getting on your internet connection and things like that. The infrastructure that runs on it normally purchased from people like, because we sort of talk about Huawei being one of the companies that are not now out of favor. So the established brands, which were after Nokia's phone business got sold off to Microsoft and they kind of moved away from that. Their biggest business is telcos, networking equipment that goes into the cabinets that connects you to the broader internet is one of the, and 5G stuff for mobile devices is where their money is. But they're going to have to axe up to 1,400 jobs because they're not making sales in the 5G market, particularly it seems in North America. Mm-hmm. In the UK, they've been handed like a golden check in a way because, again, we won't use Huawei in any of our cabs nationally. So therefore, the two major players, which are both Finnish, Ericsson and Nokia are the key two players. It's interesting how companies that pioneered the mobile phone back in the day now are now sat behind the networks and driving it rather than making the handsets that we used to use it. Now, interestingly, I mean, both Ericsson, famous for the flip phones and all that kind of stuff back in the long distant day. And now, again, another equipment provider that we've got a mast just up the road from our house and that's got loads of Ericsson and Nokia equipment inside it, you know, and that's sort of the way it is. But it's a real shame. And 20% drop in sales. So they are really being hit. They want to cut costs by somewhere between 800 million and €1 billion to try and keep the company afloat, which is from up here kind of thing to down there now for that. You know, it's interesting. I'm just saying that they're calling a lot of the problems they have with currently is the take up of 5G. That they're not outside of markets where they've got an advantage. They haven't got any advantage. So it's not helping them.
I always see these stories like this very critically. And the reason for it is I know too much about how companies work internally. I think that's part of the problem. And I'm kind of wondering how much of this is really, okay, we need to reduce costs and reduce like workflows because stuff is changing. And how much of it is, well, our revenue numbers and profits are not looking as good as we would like them to be for our investors. So we're going to fire some people and reduce costs that way instead of doing it organically like other companies would do it, where they're like, okay, if someone leaves or whatever, we just don't replace them and do it and reduce stuff like that that way and manage a little bit more long-term and a little bit more proactive. So they now fire 14,000 and then hire in January another 10,000 again.
And that those 10,000 are making less money per person than the 14,000 they fired.
And a lot of companies do that, and it's stupid.
And they have about, so it's 86,000 employees. So this is a huge chunk. You know, it's more than, you know, what is it? 18%, something like that. That's a big part of your workforce.
And if it's, done by Excel sheet where it's like, okay, we have an Excel sheet with 86,000 ordered by whatever, and we just cut off the bottom 14,000. That tells you something, that it's not about the people, it's not about their value, it's not about what they're doing. Mm-hmm. It's just about a number. That's it.
And that absolutely sucks.
And I'm sure there's some little bit of truth to, you know, 5G being slower than expected. Yeah. But like you say, you know, they take advantage of that to sort of make up for mismanagement.
Mm-hmm.
It's always mismanagement, you know, because
I mean,
if you over projected the ramp up of 5G, then that's mismanagement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. stuff can happen. Like, I don't know, whatever, pandemic happens and all of a sudden you don't have whatever. Nobody's going to movie theaters anymore or stuff like that. Okay, that's a problem. That's something really that you didn't control and where that might be a problem for you. But usually in big companies like that, especially tech companies, it's a short-term thinking problem and not a stuff happens in the environment, because you could have just reduced it some other way. I don't know. Take less flights to China.
There you go.
Save some money that way.
There's a quote in this article, Patrice, that mm-hmm. has me thinking you completely nailed what's going on. So it's a quote. Mr. Lundmark added that despite, quote, ongoing uncertainty, unquote, Nokia expects to, quote, an improvement in our network businesses in the current quarter.
Mm-hmm.
So
they're making more money.
An improvement, yeah. mm-hmm. and they're laying off all these people. I don't know that feels more to me like Patrice's hypothesis than
either they mismanaged this over the last 14,000 people, probably a long time, like a decade, and they had way too many people for a very very mm-hmm. long time. And now they have to do something about it, or more likely what I said, like it's just a short term cost saving thing to make the numbers look good. Right.
Yeah. A lot of companies here's, do that. Yep. Here's the other kind of side of the story that I'm wondering with it. Okay. With a lot of the companies or a lot of the countries in the world, Nokia and Ericsson have to face competition from lower cost Chinese brands such as Huawei. Most of those countries are where 5G networks are currently being built out. In the US, for the most part, 5G has been built out almost to an almost complete level. And there's pretty much a duopoly there of Nokia and Ericsson. So there's not as much money to be made here. And they have to compete against those lower cost 5G network equipment elsewhere. Because, I mean, Huawei had several contracts in the U.S. for wireless tower equipment before they were banned.
Yeah, I'm looking at numbers for 5G growth in the U.S. And it's kind of interesting. Statista forecast for 5G connections in North America from 2019 to 2025. And it has pre and post COVID numbers. And what post COVID meaning revised numbers based on the impact COVID has had. And there's still growth just in the US. But that's 5G connections. So that doesn't necessarily mean that that we're talking about needing to build out the infrastructure more, but at least more use.
I mean, more use often also means you need more infrastructure. Because it's not a one-to-one. Usually you build the infrastructure first and then people start using it, but you have to increase it over time, because if people are using it more, you need to balance that a little bit. And you also have more budget for it.
I don't know about other places in the world, but in my neighborhood, in my area, there is a lot of pushback on installing 5G towers. People are all freaked out, you know.
That's a U.S. problem.
I know, but I wonder if part of the slowing of the rollout, if there is probably such a thing. Yeah, I know. Around here, you can't get 5G anywhere.
Yeah, there was a brief period in Germany where I think there were some issues with cable connections and 5G, but they fixed that, so it's not a problem anymore.
Actually, one of the things people complain about is the noise of the boxes, because they have fans in them to keep it cool, and they're putting up these boxes right outside their house with a fan.
Yeah, and then everybody has an AC, and I'm like, that's way louder than that fan.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, we don't have much AC here, but yeah, in many places, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I don't understand the opposition either, but I mean,
no, 5G is everywhere here. Like,
it takes months to get a single cell tower approved here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the slow approval thing in the U.S., that's super common.
Yeah, in fact, we had one, shall I say, conspiracy theorist, city councilwoman previously, who basically tried to get things so we would be LTE only.
Wow, great.
Wow.
Yeah, that's and funny. Actually, initially, completely, basically, they put in 4G microcells when it was already clear that we were going to 5.
Well, but the good news is you all got vaccinations, so the 5G reception improved immensely after you got vaccinated.
And you got an awesome Microsoft Teams update on your implant, so.
Yes. Right. You know, I got my COVID booster yesterday, and
how's the new upgrade?
Teams is still kind of crap, and and I keep looking at the 5G signal on my phone, and it doesn't seem to have improved any. But my arm hurts.
So, yeah, you should go back. You should go back and ask them to
get another one.
Clearly broken.
Right, and I want to go take a nap. So I think I got ripped off.
By the way, the supposed imprint or diagram of the 5G chip that was floating around, that was actually a guitar pedal.
Oh my god, that's awesome.
That's
funny.
That's an overdrive pedal.
Oh my god.
That is absolutely fantastic.
Well, they told you it was a guitar pedal.
You believe? Oh, so what you're saying is they've been testing all of this 5G technology and guitar pedals because musicians are expendable.
Exactly.
Ever since the middle of 2000, or no, it would have been 2001, everything has gotten louder and heavier.
Yep. It's Eric Clapton is behind all of this, I'm telling you.
Yeah, but you know what's also louder and heavier? Nah, it's a bad transition. It's my story.
I was going to say, not TSO host.
See, no, it's not.
Here's the awesome thing. Because as soon as I heard louder and heavier, I'm like, I am using that. And then
Patrice used it
out right from under me. But instead of being angry, I'm actually really impressed. So, so why don't you just take it away, Patrice?
Sure. So, I think most people, when they think about protocols and all the standards that we have, like TCP, HTTP, all of that, people think, oh, those are rock solid things designed by really smart people and they work flawlessly and there's no problems with them. And most of that is true. They're usually rock solid. They're definitely designed by really smart people that thought about a lot of different things, but they get things wrong sometimes. And one of those things is usually unintended consequences. So the latest interesting story tidbit in that is you might have heard of HTTP2. Maybe you did. Maybe you didn't. Maybe you don't know what HTTP is, which is fine. Most people don't really realize what it is. It's the protocol behind basically all our web communication. HTTP, that's really old. That's really good. And there's a version 2 that is for last, I want to say 5 years, maybe. It's been rolling out. It's really fast. It's really efficient. Like it can, like you can basically open one connection and then do 5 things in parallel on it. So if you open a web page and it's on, it's being served on HTTP2, which these days is very likely, then like the browser can do multiple things in parallel and load all the stuff faster, which is good. Mm-hmm. The problem with that is there is built in a kind of perfect denial of service tool that people now figure out. You know, we can't have good things because someone will abuse them. So one part of this HTTP2 protocol is that you, that like something that can happen, like you open a website and then you decide, it shows a pop-up and you're like, I'll close the tab. HTTP2 has a reset command that the browser can send and say, okay, forget it, like reset or forget this request, I'm done. That's basically what it does. This can be abused, as it turns out, because there is not sufficient checks in what you reset. So smart, and I would say too smart and really bad people figured out they can basically open an HTTP2 connection, send a request and immediately reset it. And immediately say, oh, forget that. Like, don't need that anymore. And they can keep going. And there's no limit how many of those requests you can send. So you could just say, you can just keep going and say, okay, we can send 5 at a time. So you send 5, reset immediately. You send 5, reset immediately. And the servers behind them will still process them. So everyone. It still takes them, still processes them, and then says, oh, it was reset. Okay, forget it. But it has already done the work. And if you do that often enough and at enough, like large enough scale, you get this HTTP, what is it called? Reset attack, I think.
Yeah.
Rapid reset attack.
I'm just reading the CVE now. Now.
Yeah, there's probably a CVE that Google, I think, put out because they've seen this happening more and more in their data. I mean, Google is a big target. I think I saw somewhere it said like the last biggest attack that I saw was like 380 petabytes a second or something. I think it was massive. I think it was petabytes. I might be wrong. I mean, I don't know if I can see the number in here somewhere.
I mean, the interesting thing I saw from this article here was it doesn't need a lot of machines to create the denial of service. You can do it with 20,000 bots, essentially. Mm-hmm. Right. Which is a dip in the ocean.
Yeah, it's nothing.
Doesn't realize it's nothing. It's nothing.
Yeah,
like to be able to sort of really hammer a website. This mm-hmm. is incredible in terms of
like a typical denial service. You need a lot because like on HTTP 1 or 1.1, you had to basically open like send a request for something that probably hopefully takes a while to respond to, and then wait for the response and then do the next one. And you just do that a lot, and then you can basically swamp the server. But with this, you don't even need to wait. I mean, the efficiency that HTTP2 has for browsers and mobile phones or whatever is also very efficient in denial of service because you don't have to wait for the response. You can just send it and forget it. Send it, cancel it, forget it.
It just keeps saying request, never mind, request, never mind, request, exactly. Never mind. And, you never wait for anything.
Exactly. And you can do 5 at once. So it's like it's not like even just Gatling. One. You can send 5 at once.
It's a Gatling gun for DDoS mm-hmm. bots.
Yeah, so that is a problem. There is some mitigations that are possible. I mean, one is that on the implementation side of the web servers, you can keep track of those requests. And if someone is sending too many of those, you just stop responding to them. Because in a normal pattern, that wouldn't happen. It's usually, okay, I close the browser tab. Okay, I'm gone, and that's it. And then you never come back. You don't keep sending the cancels.
Do you base that on the IP address?
It can be different things. IP addresses, identifiers. Like it's there's different ways of doing that. Simply keep track of your, I mean, simply keep track of your connection. Like you can do it on a per connection basis, because it's, you can send, that's the strange thing. You can set up one HTTP connection, HTTP2, and then keep sending them on this connection.
Yeah, yeah, it would just keep bouncing and bouncing and bouncing. Yeah. The website.
Well, we took the delay out of attacks.
Yeah, exactly. So that there is, that's like even on a classic HTTP2 at DDoS, that has happened. It was, you would send 5 and then wait for the response, and then send another 5 and wait for the response. Mm. But now you don't need that anymore. And
you don't
this,
have that.
I mean, this was in the protocol from day one. It just took a while for people to figure it out. So it's, as I said, it's really, it's a really smart way of misusing this protocol and misusing a good thing for a bad thing. There
so
is
the
as
solution, is either change the protocol, or
yeah, which is not going to happen,
or individual servers need to come up with mitigations.
Yeah, changing the protocol, I mean, not really something you want to do. It was introduced for good reasons, and and I mean, worst case, I mean, you can fall back to HTTP 1.1 and you don't have that problem. So sure, it's less efficient and it has downsides, but if that is a problem for you, you could just fall back. But there is some easy mitigations that the servers can implement to simply, as I said, like once you detect abuse, just drop it, just drop the connection, say boop, you did something bad, bye. That makes it harder, because then they have to reestablish a connection that has an overhead, and if like there's enough you can do to slow that down. So, and HTTP 3 actually doesn't have that problem, because they already thought about that.
Okay.
This is why I don't work in IT, dealing with these kind of problems, which just caused me to go crazy.
Yeah, and it's so constant. It's a constant game of cat and mouse, where like someone invents something really good for really good reasons, really beneficial for everybody, and then someone figures out how to like abuse it.
Yep,
it's a little bit like that. You remember the Intel so-called bug with the out of order execution? You could attack and get a memory dump, and the first solution was turn off out of order execution, which meant your performance just
tanked.
I
remember
cliff,
that.
Yeah.
What was that called? It
had
has
a funny name.
It had a funny name. I remember that. I remember, like, I had to install that on a ton of servers.
Like, really? I'm going to turn off out of order execution? That's probably 20% performance hit.
I think it was about that. It was about a 20% performance hit. But it was the quickest way of doing that. Like, I think that they rolled out that as a patch first, and then Intel figured
Which
out how
made
to
sense.
Fix it. Yeah, because that is bad. Like, if you get a memory dump and you can just get it from anywhere, it's a problem.
That's kind of a problem.
That's, yes, that's definitely a problem.
Yeah, it was like you could remotely, like on any server, like as long as it had any connection open somewhere, you could find a way to get to that.
And
that
there's
is
a lot
bad
of good,
because you have all the passwords and keys and everything in there.
Wow.
So, yeah. So this, as I said, I wanted to highlight this. This is an interesting thing that's happening. It has a CVE. Google found it in their data. It's happening all over the world. It will get solved. Like, it's not a, I mean, it's not a big deal in that sense. I mean, it eats up. The bad thing about this is it eats up a lot of bandwidth in general on the internet. Like, you would think, oh, Netflix and all of them, they're using a lot of bandwidth. Yes, they are. But those DDoS attacks, they're eating up a lot of bandwidth.
Imagine how many packets going across the internet are just for DDoS attempts or actual
attacks in general. Right. Any attacks, like
spam,
I mean,
and
look at your server logs, and you will see, like, it's constant. There's a constant barrage of usually not very sophisticated attacks.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, I know when I had a SSH on a standard port exposed to the internet for not very long. The amount of attacks is like, you think,
but most of them are not.
It's just, oh, for God's sake, it's just stupid.
Yeah. You get like maliciously crafted HTTP requests on an SSH port, stuff like that. I'm like, okay, they tried.
Yeah, you're
good for them.
Really? Are you trying passwords? Oh, fair enough. Go on. For God's sake. And
it's unfortunately what I live with every day.
Yeah, it sounds like a fun.
That kind of sucks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is the kind of stuff, like, if you're working in this industry, you have to pay attention to, because, I mean, yeah, Google and Microsoft and like the big players are targets, but so can like anybody. Like, some competitor might not like you, or there's a competitor from, let's say, a not so friendly or a very hacker friendly countries, and you know which ones I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And they might see a benefit of just targeting you, whether you're a small company or not. Like, if they see a benefit in doing so, they'll try. They'll try to take it down. If you're competing with them somewhere, somehow, you're toast.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just the big guys. And the only way to protect against that is not something you can do. That's something on the network layer, that like your ISP, your data center provider, like, they have to do that, because it has to be dropped.
So if you're being hosted, say, through AWS,
mm-hmm. Amazon has to do that.
Amazon is going to take care of the problem.
Yeah, because by the time it reaches your server, so they have to drop it as early as possible, basically. Okay. Detect it, drop it. And that's what Google and Amazon, all of them, are doing. That's why they have so big... like site reliability engineers, security engineers. They have massive teams for this. They have tools for this. They have AI for this, because that's exactly what they do. The earlier they detect it, the less damage it takes or it makes.
All right. So this causes, is something whatever, that ultimately affects everyone at some mm-hmm. point.
Yeah. We pay for it. I mean, honestly, yeah, we pay for this, because if Amazon charges you for a minute of their servers, that is built in cost. Like, sure, it's probably a fraction of a cent on that, like, low down level, but you pay for that. Amazon doesn't do that for free.
No, they do nothing for free.
Mm-mm.
Amazon does not get up in the morning for free. Heck, they don't even sleep for free.
Also true. Yep. All right. Well, so, inconvenience, I think, takes us to Tom's story, which also addresses inconvenience. Tell us about that, Tom.
This is a DDoS attack of a different sort. Last week, there was a joke, about me being a couple weeks ago, about being in a rocking chair because I'm retired. And the joke was, all of our chairs are rocker chairs because I live in earthquake country.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
yesterday morning at about 9:30 in the morning, everybody who had it turned on got an alert from, it's called Shake Alert. It comes from the U.S. Geological Survey, USGS. And it said, I got this message and it said, you know, earthquake, you know, I forget what it said, do something safe. I can't remember. Earthquake warning.
Duck and cover.
So you're right, basically duck and cover. And I thought, wow, because it was the first time I've had it turn off for a long time, but this is the first time I got the notification. So I did exactly what you shouldn't do. I was just paralyzing. Oh, what should I do? And then I thought, I remembered in the back of my head that there was a test plan for this system. I go, oh, that must be the test. Well, it turned out the test is actually for today, not yesterday, and it was a real earthquake warning. There was an earthquake, turned out to be a magnitude of 4, I think it was 4.1, and it was located, that was early, mm-hmm. one of the earlier estimates I saw, and it was out in a place, kind of Bethel Island, kind of halfway between here and Sacramento, so about 100 miles away from me, and it turned out to be no big deal. So the first thing I thought was, wow, I've been looking forward to this. You know, if they can ever give you even 10, 20, 30 seconds of warning about a real earthquake, that would be valuable. You know, to dive under a desk or to get out of the house or whatever it takes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's only valuable if you know what you have to do.
Right. You still have to have a plan. You still have mm-hmm. to have a plan and know what to do. And, you know, my reaction shows that I'm not used to this at all. I clearly didn't react correctly. But the other thing that, you know, and it was all over Mastodon, people were posting, hey, did you get the alert? Did anybody feel it? Nobody felt it. And there were a couple of people that were saying, well, this is stupid. What a waste of time. Why are they giving me these warnings? It was only a 4-point whatever. They should only do it for 5 and above. Oh, my God. You know? You know, the big inconvenience that for maybe 30 seconds or a minute you had to, you know, do something. Anyway, so I read an article today from the USGS, which is, you know, to give you a sufficient amount of warning, they have to make a obviously a very quick call on whether what the magnitude of the earthquake was going to be. And their initial estimate was it was going to be over 5.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the right place, a magnitude 5 can do some damage, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it seemed totally reasonable. And I'm just wondering if, you know, the normal people are going to, you know, think it's crying wolf all the time and not pay attention to them. Anyway, I thought I was so excited to actually get this alert.
I was like, we had our like the siren alarms here, like the yearly test recently. And for me, it was a good reminder that you should think about that and plan. I mean, hopefully you will never, ever, ever need it. But it's good to be prepared and say, okay, well, if this happens, what do I do? Where do I go? What do I take? Like, stuff like that. So
I think it's a really good habit. When they do the test, that's a good time to do your checkup.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, to your point, like it's always a balance with these alarms. Because if you do them too often and turns out to be nothing, then people get complacent. I mean, it's really funny in air quotes. If I talk to my friends in Ukraine, they're like, oh, there was another air raid alarm today. I'm like, they didn't even move. They didn't even go anywhere. Like, it happens every day. So they get just numb to that because it's happening every day and nothing bad has happened to them or rarely happened in their vicinity even. So they're like, you just get complacent. So it's as I said, it's always a balance between doing it when it's necessary, but not too oft, so people just ignore it.
Yeah, I agree. I also think, you know, the technology is amazing. I don't know what kind of analysis they do with the sensors that tells them they should put out a warning. And I'm sure it's going to take years and years of refinement to make that better and better and better. But it's got to be a very interesting analytical problem about how you best do that, you know. And I'm not sure how you test it, you know.
So in 2000, like late 2000s, there was a paper that I actually did a report on in school. That at that point, 2009, probably 10-ish, I want to say, that at that point, Twitter was faster in putting out an alarm, like an actual alarm and warning people, than the USGS.
Right.
Because at that point, I think they were probably manually reviewing it and then putting out a post and whatever. And that for sure, I mean, and they had to be accurate. Like Twitter is like, nobody has any expectations that Twitter is accurate. But they had to be accurate. If they put something out and say this was a whatever, a 5.3, it has to be a 5.3. Mm-hmm. Can't be anything else because that's their job. So that was really interesting. But it like the Twitter was actually a better predictor than what was happening than government agencies. So that has changed. I think these days you can't rely on Twitter or X at all.
Yeah.
Clearly not. But back then that was really interesting. And I'm guessing since then that the USGS has refined their probably software. I mean, I'm guessing this is fully automated because if a human has to review it, it's too late. By the time the person sees the notification, even if they have a 24/7 command center where someone just sits there and does that. But the time they've seen the data and reviewed it and decided, okay, let's hit the button, it's probably too late.
Too late. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. This is something that, even though my brain is not working today. This is something that is right now only in the Ring of Fire states of California, Oregon, and Washington. But this is something I do want to see go nationwide, because there is a fault zone off the Carolinas, and personally, I exist in the extreme upper end of the impact zone for the Wabash and New Madrid seismic zones. And quite frankly, since because of our the way the soil is in the Midwest, if the big one, when the big one comes here, it's going to do a lot more damage than it would in California, because there's nothing stopping it. It just
liquefies,
keeps going in the dirt.
Yeah. Well, I think it also depends. Obviously, it heavily depends on the instrumentation and the location. You need a lot of sensors to do this well. You know, I've seen along the San Andreas where they have boxes. You know, they put boxes and somehow it communicates back to some controls command center and somebody's collecting all that data.
Yeah, they have them all over the world. It's really interesting. Like my dad was a geologist, so I've kind of grew up with stuff like this, and it was really interesting. Like, I watched the USGS site quite a lot, and it's really interesting. They can detect earthquakes that happen all over the world. They can detect, I mean, back in the day, they could detect, like, nuclear tests and stuff like that. I mean, I think they still do, like, if North Korea is doing something, they can see, because it has a very distinctive pattern, can see that, and see that the, even if it's, like, below ground somewhere, they can see the tests that were done. So it's really interesting, like, how... Like, you would think, oh, like, if something happens in Japan, like how would the USGS know about it? But it's far away, but it's still, like, it still travels through the Earth, and they can still detect it. And
right.
Then
the Earth,
figure
Earth
out where it was
conductor.
And go back. Yeah, and then figure out where it was and go back and say, okay, if we measured it here at this point and with this magnitude, then it was probably this big over here. And then confirm it.
Right.
So, and this is a big global network, by the way. There is a global network of all those stations. They're all talking to each other.
Which is...
Hopefully, they're not running HTTP2, though.
Right. Yeah. Probably not, because probably they don't need that. It's not that that's that much data.
Oh, if they're running HTTP2, Yellowstone would go off.
Yeah, but it's really, I mean, if you look at the USGS site, there is an earthquake, I don't know how often, but
all
very often, multiple times a day at least, somewhere in the world, big and small.
There's a Mastodon account for USGS that I follow, or somebody linked to the Twitter or something, so I see them every day.
Yeah,
I just signed up for the California ones, or West Coast ones, but there's two or three every day.
Yeah, as I said, in the world, there's all the time, little ones all the time, which is it's a good thing, because that releases some tension.
A lot of little ones is better than one big one.
That's
exactly.
Right.
Yeah, we have ton. I mean, you know, the Alps is kind of tectonic plates going into each other. So there's a lot of earthquakes here, but it's a lot of small ones. Usually it's like 2.8, 3.2, happens all the time.
In fact, here's a little interesting thing. There was a 2.7 magnitude quake today in South Dakota, basically on the Iowa and Minnesota border.
Wow.
Yeah, that's at 2.7, you barely, especially if it's short, you barely notice.
Yeah, most recent in Colorado was 3 days ago in Trinidad, which... That tends to be a concentrated area for earthquakes in Colorado, but they're deeper. So like 5 kilometers deep, 2.8 magnitude. So typically the earthquakes in Colorado are noted not by people saying, did you feel that? But by someone looking at a map and saying, oh, look, one happened. Yeah.
Well, and it all depends where they hit, where the epicenter is. You know, the earthquake in San Francisco in 1989, the epicenter was 50 miles south. And it just traveled up to San Andreas, up into San Francisco, you know. So actually, if this alert system had existed, you know, if you're 50 miles away from the epicenter, it might have given you 15, 20, 30 seconds of warning if it were.
Yeah. Yeah, but I do have to say, the last time we had a... earthquake here in my neck of the woods, people had a nice little picture of of yard furniture being thrown to the ground saying, "We will rebuild."
You know what you don't have to rebuild because it's super reliable and super solid? That would be
TSO hosts.
That's right. And what makes TSO Host awesome is that, well, they provide web hosting services and they are super reliable. And they make it easy to get your domain names, do your hosting, all of that. And what they're doing is taking all of that and leveraging it so that we can do what we do. TSO Host is very generously giving us the bandwidth we need to live stream shows every single week. They're giving us the hosting space we need, so there's a place for the British Tech Network website to live. They're giving us all of that server space we need so that that we can have the recordings of the shows right there ready and waiting for you so you can watch or listen to your favorite episodes at your leisure. The resources it takes to do this is crazy, and it's more than we would be able to manage on our own. So we really, really appreciate that TSO Host is here helping us out, giving back to the community, and letting us be here to do what we do. So thank you, TSO Host. Now, I just said thank you. You can say thank you too. But since you don't have a microphone in front of you to say it live like I am right now, you can do the more permanent thing, which is put it out on social media and thank TSO Host for being here and supporting us. Doesn't take much more than a few seconds to do. And the return on that is great because you're letting TSO Host know that we appreciate that they're here helping us out. So please go do that. Now, when you decide that you're ready to get a domain name and set up your own website, well, why not use TSO Host? Because we're sitting here today and every week proving how rock solid they are. So go find your perfect domain name, throw it in your cart, and figure out what hosting package you need, throw it in your cart, and then toss in the discount code BTN20 so you get 20% off that order. What that means is that in addition to being incredibly generous and supporting the British Tech Network so we can be here for you, they're giving you a discount, a really nice discount on what they do just because you're part of the BTN family. So thank you, TSO Hosts, for being here and supporting us. And speaking of support, if everyone's watched the last couple of weeks while Patrice was out and I was doing the whole thing about the chat,
it was only a week.
It felt like a month, Patrice.
Or two.
All right. So last week, which felt like an incredibly long time for me because I had to talk about the chat. Patrice, show people how Real Professional does it, please.
Yeah, so we have a really cool live chat where you can talk to us live. Like when we are recording this show, which we are doing usually Thursdays at 7 p.m. UK time, whenever that is in your time zone, 7 p.m. UK time, summertime, winter time, doesn't matter. It's always 7 p.m. Because winter time is now coming up very soon. Actually, might be happening soon, yeah.
Next weekend.
Yeah, so that's happening. I should remember that. Yeah, and then you can head over to our live chat. Like when we're recording, head over to chat.britishtechnetwork.com and you can talk to us live. That's how easy it is. Like just go there, talk to us, have fun. It's really awesome. But let's say you are listening to this in the recorded form. You're like, in your favorite podcast player of choice on the website. Our website is actually using HTTP2. So, hey, there's that. You can still get to like all the cool links that we're posting, for example. Like there's all the news stories that we talked about, plus some extras that we posted, some extra links that we like weren't news stories. There's like links to cool things that are coming up. All of the really cool stuff all of that you can still get to. Sure, you can't join the live chat anymore. That's not how it works, but you can get our transcript. And in order to get to that, you head over to britishtechnogroup.com/chat. And then there's a little calendar that asks you very nicely on our website for a date. And you very nicely, hopefully, put in today's date as we're recording this, which is the 19th of October, 2023. 19th of October, 2023. And if you put that into that nice little calendar, the website will show you everything that we talked about.
Awesome. Thank you for doing that, Patrice. You do that so much better than I do. And I don't think I can ever reach that level of competence.
Give it another 10 years.
Fair. All right.
Eventually.
Yeah. Okay. 10 years. That sounds about right. Okay. Well, so now it means it's time for cool things. And let's see. It looks like, Tom, you have the first cool thing here already. So tell us about it.
Well, Jeff, are you done explaining the chat? I thought we had more time for you to explain the chat. Sorry.
Yeah, no, we did schedule more time for me to explain the chat. However, since Patrice was here, we were able to get through that at HTTP2 speeds.
Seriously, Jeff, you do the chat explanation fine. You do a good job. I mean, we gave you grief last week, and Ben and I, we were wrong. You were right. So anyway.
Well, never well, that's a rare thing. So just mark the day on the calendar.
Okay. My cool thing is called PRX Remix. It's a stream from PRX, and it's basically a curated stream of podcasts. PRX is a podcast distributor, incubator. They do a lot of things related to radio shows and podcasts. You've probably in the U.S. You may have heard of them, or you might listen to shows like This American Life and a bunch of other shows that they sort of manage. Mm-hmm. That's probably the most popular one. PRX Remix is a curated stream of podcasts. And so what they do is they kind of look through their universe of podcasts and radio shows, and they take out parts of those, and they basically make a playlist out of it. And so you can get a 24/7 stream. Either there are a bunch of stations, a bunch of places where you can get a 24/7 stream. Some radio stations in the U.S. on their stream play it at different times during the day. And I've been listening for a long time, probably 7-8 years. And I find it really good for podcast discovery. Or if you're just like, hey, I'm sick of all of my podcasts, let me just hear two or three snippets of other podcasts. So in an hour, you probably get two to four snippets of a podcast, you know, one story from a podcast or one section from a podcast. And they change up the playlist probably every month or so. So, and I think it's a 24 hour. I don't think it repeats except every 24 hours. So it if you listened all day, you wouldn't hear the same thing. And I bring this up for a couple of reasons. One is I should have brought it up before because I use it all the time. I like listening to it for both discovery and when I've run out of stuff. And the second thing is I donate to PRX, and there were a couple of people from their sort of consumer engagement side that were in San Francisco last week. And so they sent me an email. Hey, you're a contributor. Would you like to have lunch with us and talk about what you think about PRX? I'm like, yeah, sure. You know, whatever. It sounds fine. Cool. I'm not sure why you want to talk to me, but fine. And they were staying at our local station, KQED, in Potrero Hill section of San Francisco, which is a cool place. And they picked a cool place to have lunch. So that was good. And for all of us on here, what you would appreciate, it was basically 2 hours of nerd talk about podcasts and radio shows. So much fun. from, you know, talking to people that actually work in the industry and do all this. And so PRX is a cool place. I think they do a lot of good things. Of course, they're struggling with monetization and everything else. But if you ever find yourself short on podcasts or radio shows, check out the PRX Remix.
Awesome. All right. Well, it's on my list now. Cool. All right, Ben, tell us about your cool thing.
Well, I'm going to talk to you about a show with glorious purpose.
Glorious.
Yes. Coming off the heels of Ant-Man and whatever the tagline of Ant-Man 3 was, Quantumania, Loki Season 2 has arrived. We have another season of hijinks between multiple Lokis, the TVA, Kang, and a weird AI that actually might be less terrible than the person that plays her. It's so far, it is really good. Hold on one second here. I forgot how to say his name, but
Tom Hiddleston?
No.
Owen Wilson? I know those aren't the names you're going for.
But... I know that. Yeah. Ki Hu Kwan.
Yes. Yes.
Who was, of course, one of Indy's sidekicks as a kid.
Then, oh, him. Yeah.
Yes. Then grew up to be now one of the most respected actors in Hollywood.
He recently played everything everywhere all at once. I had exactly the same thought, Jeff.
Yep. Oh, yeah, wow. He was really good. Yeah, he plays OB, who is an actual major character from the comics. He's kind of like the tech person at the TVA. He literally wrote the book on it.
Mm-hmm. And they've forgotten about him for like 400 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nobody visits him.
Okay.
But it's the character is so well done. He is so freaking hilarious in the role. And I mean, this is a guy you root for anyway, because he is just an absolutely great human being.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's just like one of those characters that you want to see him everywhere in the MCU now.
Yeah, me too. It's my favorite character in the show now.
Yeah.
I mean, Loki is fun and everything. Oh, yeah. Sure. But and I like all the other characters, but he's my favorite.
Yeah. Because I mean, Owen Wilson as Mobius and not Morbius. That's something that should be pruned from time. And right. Tom Hiddleston, they all play off each other so well. I mean, they get each other's comedic timing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the what's her name? The female Loki, I'm also like.
Sophia
DiMartia.
Yeah, she's really good too. Yeah. Really like her.
Yes. I was completely enamored in season one with Hunter B-15, and I can't remember the actress's name.
Mm-hmm.
And we have two episodes in season two so far, and she's awesome in both.
I'm going to completely butcher her name. Wunmi Masaku. I am so sorry if you're listening to us. Then we have another brand new character, Hunter X5, who is also hilarious. The guy is a complete douche, but it's played in such a fun way.
It's a fun character.
So true.
And Eugene Cordero is back.
Yeah. Just being Casey. Eugene Cordero. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So pretty much, I mean, whether it's Loki or Lower Decks, he basically plays the same type of character, but it's always really, really good.
Yeah, so true.
I'm looking forward to this evening for episode 3. And yeah, okay, Loki, another great pick. All right, so Patrice, your turn.
So mine is also a really great TV show, a little bit older than Loki. It's something that you recommended to me, Jeff, at Star Wars Rebels. So that's from 2014, I think.
That sounds about right. A while. I'm glad you're liking it.
I mean, for someone who does not like, mostly doesn't like animated things, with some very notable exceptions like Prodigy, for example, or Lower Decks, or Avatar The Last Airbender, I really like this show. It's a lot of fun. It's short episodes, like 20-ish minutes, 20-ish 25 minutes. Mm-hmm. Something like that. I said, I'm not a big Star Wars fan either. I'm like, mostly it's boring. I don't like it very much, but this is good. It's really well made. It's something I'm watching for lunch mostly. But I've also binged, like, I'm somewhere in season 2 now. I had to restart it because I somehow lost track of it. I was doing something else. I was busy. So I started over, and I'm really enjoying it. So thumbs up
for
that.
I'm glad you're enjoying it.
Yeah, it's at Disney Plus if you want it. So easy, yeah, easy peasy.
It's great. I enjoy that while it was pitched originally as a children's show or a YA show because it's animated and that's how you get that stuff made.
Yeah.
This has so many seriously adult topics addressed in really, really good ways.
Yeah, exactly. And I think because this is animated, they are also free to do more things. So the robots especially are quite interesting, like all the different kinds of robots they have. I mean, like my favorite is still, what's this little guy's name? I'm blanking on it.
Chopper?
Chopper, yeah. Chopper is awesome. Like,
yeah, it's Chopper just a fun... has a great personality.
Yeah, great person, which is something that one of the few things that I really like about Star Wars, that I don't like about Star Trek at all, they have really, really interesting robots usually. They have personality. They're not just boring boxes that do stuff. So they have their own languages and their own quirks and their own personalities, and they talk back and all of that. It's like they're kind of little humans, and that makes them really interesting. So...
Yeah.
Yeah. And I really like that. Said it's a really good show. Well, and it's a good story. Like, it's not just the way it's done. The stories are really, really good.
Yes. Yep. Well, now that I know that you're watching Rebels, I'm looking forward to our discussions about the episodes and plot lines and overarching stories. And yeah. Yeah. I have a feeling there will be several points throughout the series where you're like, oh, I have to talk to Jeff about this.
Yeah, that's gonna totally gonna happen. You will at some point get a OMG, OMG, OMG for me.
Yeah, yep. It's one of those shows that it started out as a YA show. By the end of season 4, it literally changed Star Wars forever.
I can already into season 2. You can already see that.
Yeah, in fact. Do not watch do not watch Ahsoka without watching Rebels first.
Well, I did it the other way around, and I'm actually really enjoying it because I also have the context of Ahsoka.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
But
so I know what's going to happen a little bit, and it's kind of a story of, okay, how did they get there? Like, okay, we're here, they're there. Like, what happened in between? It's so intriguing. What happened?
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Okay,
yeah.
I'm really regretting watching half of this stuff. I'm probably going to end up browsing, binging on much of this over lunchtime.
Yeah, but it's not too many episodes. Like I said, they're like 20, 25 minutes long. There's like, I think 15. Yeah, season 4 has 15 episodes. I'm guessing the other seasons are not that much longer. Yeah, okay, 15 to 20 episodes a season, so not so much content.
I do have to say season 1 is probably the worst of them.
Yeah, but still fine.
And it's a good season. Once it starts going, it goes. In fact, it might actually be my favorite Star Wars series other than Andor.
Okay. I didn't like Andor, so it wasn't my thing.
And this is why I'm glad there's so many different Star Wars. So that there's a flavor for everyone.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the thing I really enjoy. Like, there's different shows now for different people, and it's not just the movies that are kind of all the same.
Though I do have to say, for the ones that center on the Force, thank God for the character of Carson Teva. Because they actually, in Ahsoka, in universe, acknowledge how ridiculous the everyday citizens of the galaxy will think this all is.
Yes. Okay. Yep.
It is ridiculous.
Yep. Awesome. Well, Patrice, I'm super excited that you're enjoying Rebels. Okay, so that brings us to Ian. Tell us about your cool thing.
My cool thing is Ian tries yet another web browser. I mean, to be fair, this time it's more it's more a case of I was baited by the title of it being the fastest web browser in all the world. So I thought, go on. I'll add it to yet another one on my list of many web browsers that lurk on my machine. And it's actually, if you want something that's Chrome, that's not Google's, and you want it very lightweight, that runs very quickly on most platforms, he even supports some very old platforms, and it runs on Linux as well. It looks quite a nice choice for the little play I've had with it up to now. Yeah. He's coded it to be very, very responsive. I mean, he's done all manner of clever coding around it. I mean, the website does look like it was written in 1990 or something, but a guy called Alexander Fricker, or Frick, he's written his own stuff. So he's taken the code and basically turned everything up as much as he can for performance. I mean, it's a bigger executable, but you get better performance. I thought that's worth a play with for a little bit. It'll get binned at some point, but it was an interesting exercising. Where's Chrome now? For me.
That's cool.
So,
awesome. I love that people are experimenting like this.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's the reason that I'm here. I'm playing around with things like this. It is that exact thing.
That's awesome. Oh,
look, that's really cool.
Yeah, I think for me, I'm at the point where I'm not happy with any browser at this point. So it is nice that people are taking stabs at it.
Yeah, I mean, the Arc one I've been using is very, very good. But there are some bits you think you don't have to make it that complicated. You know, there's some stuff where if you start turning off all the extra fancy bits on top, well, I've got another Chrome browser, and then they've let the layout slightly weird, and I can't get to the extensions always quite nicely. Well, where's the address bar gone? And you kind of think, I'll give up now. I'll go back to a more standard one. And it's just kind of this circular pissing about I seem to be doing with every browser under the sun, but it's interesting anyway. Under the skin, it's all the bloody same. But this thing gets really good performance values if you put it through, what was that thing called? The bookmark, the browser test suite. Speedometer? Is that what it's called? Speedometer, yeah.
Okay.
And if you run that test on, he's got his own compiled version, but if you run even the standard ones, it's twice as fast as the other browsers on my system. You know, it's ridiculous.
Cool.
So interesting.
All right. Well, another browser for me to check out. So thanks for that. Yeah. All right. So my cool thing, apparently I got the memo that we're all doing TV shows, movies, and just entertainment stuff. And Ian, I totally appreciate that finding a new web browser is entertainment for you. So that still qualifies.
Yes, it does qualify as entertainment. I am that sad.
Castlevania Nocturne. So Castlevania animated series on Netflix ran for 4 seasons, I believe, and it was based on the Castlevania video games, and it was really well done. It's animated. This is very much an adult show. I mean, do not let little kids watch this, because it will screw them up. So they wrapped up that whole series and everyone still wanted more Castlevania. So it's been a few years and they just released Castlevania Nocturne, and it's a vampire story. And this season, and I don't know if it's going to be multiple seasons because I'm only part way into it, but it moves forward in the future. So it is now taking place in France during its revolution. And so there's the whole political thing going on, but then there's this whole under the radar thing, if you will, with a vampire invasion in France. And so you have these people that now are having to try and deal with the vampires and the other dangerous and evil things that follow along in their path, while there's the whole French Revolution happening too. And I've only seen a few episodes.
Vampires and the Jacobins.
Yeah, there you go. So anyhow, really well done so far. And based on what I've watched, which is like the first three episodes, I can't imagine that it suddenly takes a turn for the worse. Anyhow, so Castlevania Nocturne, it's on Netflix. I'm really enjoying it. What I've seen so far tells me that if you haven't watched the four seasons of Castlevania, that's okay. If you just want to jump in and watch this, you won't be lost. It's nicely self-contained. So there you go.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So Patrice, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me every week here on The Big Show on Thursdays. Also tomorrow and every week on The Mac Show on Fridays. If you want to hear us talk about Apple things. Like here we talk about general tech and CPUs and everything. Fridays is our Apple show. So anything goes up there. So head over to that. If you are interested in everything else I'm doing, like all the social media links, the podcasts, the projects, literally everything, you can head over to my website, thepatrice.com, because there's only one and that's me. Mm-hmm. And if you want to listen to really cool people talk about food and food-related stories and memories, I have an interview show called Foodie Flashback at foodieflashback.com.
Awesome, and welcome back.
Thank you.
Ben, where can people find you?
Well, Jeff, you can find me on social media at Ben Rithig. You can find me on the web at rithig.tech. Tuesday nights, you can find me on Mac Voices with Mr. Chuck Joyner. Thursday nights, you can find me on In Touch with iOS with Mr. Dave Ginsburg. And of course, Thursday and Friday, you can find me here on the British Tech Network on The Big Show and The Mac Show.
Awesome. And I'm looking forward to seeing you this evening when we get to hang out with Dave. Yeah. Ian, where can people find you?
People can find me in the usual places. I'm here every Thursday on The Big Show. And the other best place to find me is on LinkedIn. Over here, when I can finally get my finger to point nicely the right done. Thing. Ian Grant, Veeam. I post semi-regularly on LinkedIn about various bits to do with backup technology. I've just posted a link to one of our new seminars that's coming up and things like that. So all good.
Awesome. And welcome back.
Thank you.
And Tom, where can people find you?
People can find me on Mastodon. I am Tom F at sfba.social.
Awesome. And I'm glad the earthquake was a non-event for you.
Thank you. Me too.
Yeah. All right. So you can find me on social medias as Jay Gamut, mostly active on Mastodon and Instagram. Then for shows, most Tuesdays on Chuck Joyner's Mac Voices Live, then most Thursdays on Dave Ginsburg's In Touch with iOS, then here on the British Tech Network, Thursdays for the Big Show, then back on Fridays for the Mac Show. And Brian Chaffin and I also record The Context Machine. And with that, we're done. So, wow, thank you to all of you for putting a smile on my face, because this world needs more smiles, and all of you, you just make me happy. So thank you. And for everyone that's watching, listening live, participating in the chat, thank you for being here as well. All of you are absolutely awesome, and I'm so glad you're here. For everyone that watches or listens later, thank you for being part of the BTN family as well. I'm just glad we all get to be part of this. And Ewan, thank you for being you. Muller, thank you for making sure we have people for shows. TSO host, thank you for making sure that we are actually here, because you're giving us all those resources. So thank you. If you're not watching, listening, I don't even know how technology works anymore, apparently. The Daily News Show. Listen, take it in. It's awesome. And throw some money towards it too, so we can keep that going, because Kyle is giving us an amazing service for super cheap. So please, please check out the Daily News Show. All right. And let's see. Be sure to join us tomorrow for the Mac Show. I have a feeling there will be some things worth discussing. And then don't forget to tune in next week for the Big Show again. And everyone, have a wonderful weekend.